I want to show you a bit of film. Because the night after the human fly appeared on 90 Minutes Live, he went to Olympic Stadium in Montreal, and before a crowd, as you'll see in a film we'll show you in just a moment, of not very many people, he tried to jump on a motorcycle over 26 buses. Now, here's what happened that night in Montreal.
Hello, high flyers, and welcome to the Death Defying Human Flycast. I'm Max Romero, your host on this one-of-a-kind journey into the world of the superhero stuntman called the Human Fly, the wildest superhero ever, because he was real. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, Captain Entropy. Welcome to the show, Cap.
Thanks very much, Max. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, I'm going to ask you the first question I always ask everybody. Have you ever read The Human Fly before this?
No. You introduced me to The Human Fly. I had heard of him before, but I had never seen the joy that was The Human Fly on a comics panel.
Well, we're going to see with this storyline that one man's joy might be another man's mass confusion. Well, offhand, what did you think of this story?
I really thought this story was great. I don't know what your take on it is, so I might be too easily pleased in your eyes, but it occurred to me as I was looking at this, maybe the reason they canceled it wasn't because the human fly disappeared. It wasn't because the sales were slipping. It was because Bill Mantlow couldn't keep topping himself every month, him and Lee Elias. Because I really thought this one had a powerful message and told it pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to go ahead and spoil it. I loved it. I love every issue of The Human Fly.
Awesome.
And that's not going to change. Of course, it's a 70s Bronze Age Marvel comic, so it has its quirks. But I love those, too. I'm a fan of Mantlow. I don't know how familiar you are with Bill Mantlow's work.
No, I'm definitely a fan of his. I'm sure you remember Rom.
Of course.
I was not really a fan of the art on Rom. I can't remember who the artist was right now, but it was certainly acceptable and it told the story well. But it was funny because I got so invested in the characters because of Bill Mantlow that I read it despite not being thrilled with the art. And, you know, he did a great job on Micronauts, and he did a great job even when Marvel allowed him to write non-licensed characters.
Mm-hmm. That is true. Yeah, Mantlow just was able to just sort of spin gold out of almost anything. It was, even if it was crazy, it was well written. And I always appreciate that about Mantlow.
Yeah, me too, absolutely. Not to be a downer, but given the fact, I mean, as we're reading this issue, I couldn't keep out of my head the fact that he was himself a victim of an accident. Mm-hmm. And it's a message of hope in the story, and that's a positive thing that he left behind, part of his legacy.
You know, I think you might be the first person to actually mention that. And that's a good point. You know, he was in a very debilitating accident that unfortunately he wasn't able to human fly himself out of because, you know, this is the real world. But it is very interesting that, and I've mentioned this before, that the human fly, his whole point is to give hope to people. And that is the crux of this story. Just to kind of lay it out a little bit, the human fly goes through a crisis of belief in himself and of his mission. And so that's interesting to see someone who is so invested in giving hope to others almost kind of losing hope in himself.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, but then also seeing him come back from that. And another thing that's great about this issue, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but you see his effect, or the effect of his experiences, not only on himself, but his effect on those around him. And I think it's kind of, it's a little bit, not to make a comparison that Michael Bailey might think sacrilegious, but it's a little bit like Superman in that respect. One of the most interesting things about Superman is how people react to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the human fly is very much an aspirational character, especially for a character that swears up and down again and again that he is not a superhero. And that's not what he's trying to do. But in spite of himself, he is maybe not a superhero, but definitely a hero.
Yeah, there's absolutely, he's a hero. And there's one there's one page in this comic where that whole not a superhero thing, that's just maybe more than any other issue, gives a lie to it, because it talked about how happy he was after he teamed up to beat the bad guys with Daredevil and White Tiger.
Right.
That whole not a superhero line they keep repeating, or used to. I think by now maybe they've given up on it, but that just popped in my head when I saw it.
Right. Yeah. For someone who doesn't consider himself a superhero, he seems to enjoy being a superhero every now and then. Did your experience with Matt Lowe give you any kind of preparation on what to expect in this comic?
Yeah, I think it did, because one thing it told me was, like you said, he seems to spin gold out of anything. And, you know, and his comics are high drama. There's going to be a lot of action, but there's also going to be a lot of human emotion. It's very Bronze Age Marvel, you know, and
right.
And the other thing is that I've, not to be too much of a kiss up, but I've listened to every episode of The Human Fly, and that's been excellent preparation for reading this issue.
Oh, well, great. That's good. That's good to know. Yeah. There is not a single issue in, the 19 issue run that is not absolutely insane. And then you're kind of right. I get the feeling that Bill Mantlo was constantly trying to top himself. I would have loved to have seen where he went with that, if it had kept going, if they hadn't canceled the title. But there's plenty of action and fun and just kind of joy, to steal a line from Shag, in these 19 issues to fill a few years worth of titles.
This story made me wonder even more about what the real story of the human fly is. And I know that's something you've talked a lot about on this podcast, and you compared him to DB Cooper early on. I think that's a good comparison, but just what was the effect of that crash? Mm-hmm. Where is he now? There are so many questions that pop in your mind. I think partly because Matt Lowe and Elias made him seem so real in the comic book. And I know that's not the real guy, and maybe the real guy's not like that, but because of how real they made the character, I'm more interested in the person who's out in the real world than meat space.
Right. You know, and that's a good point. The writing on the comic book makes you want to believe that the real person is like the comic book version of the human fly, which speaks well of Matt Lowe's writing. And it's kind of, to me, what comics are all about. We want to believe in people with these ideals and with these values. And, you know, you mentioned Superman. In a way, the human fly is even more aspirational, because he is not a superpowered alien from another planet. He is a guy who managed to rebuild his life, in a sense. And we all kind of want to believe that we can do that.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And Superman is in some ways a different challenge, because you have a guy that's so powerful, and this is been covered in a lot of versions of Superman, but he has temptations we don't have. So, you know, there's a moral challenge of, are you going to, if you had all this power, could you be as good as he is? And the real question is, most of the time we can't be as good as he is without all that power.
Right. You
know? And the human fly is like, it's a related question, but it's a different question, which is like, if you had all this tragedy, could you overcome it and then be an inspiration to others, you know? And then the next question is, how can you be an inspiration in your daily life now? The human fly had these experiences, but I really don't want to have the car crash and the motorcycle crash and everything else in order to get better in my own life.
Right. And I think part of the message of the human fly in general is, for the most part, you don't have to. You know, because it's a lot of times the human fly is helping people with disabilities. He's helping children. He's, you know, it's usually for some sort of charity or something like that. But he inspires people from all walks of life and all backgrounds and all abilities. And I think that's nice. Of course, you don't want a character who is ableist, who wants to make it seem as if you can't lift yourself out of a bed, you know, that you failed somehow. But I think part of what the human fly is about is encouraging characters, and by extension, I guess, readers, to meet their own potential. I find that really refreshing. Even in those days, I don't think that was something that you necessarily saw from a whole lot of characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can tell even in the character design of the people around him, right? So his stunt engineer has a disability. He has prosthetics for hands. So it's, you know, it's 1978 and his driver slash pilot is a female African-American. One of the people he inspires in this issue is a journalist, and I don't mean to imply that's a disability, Max. I know you're a journalist.
I was gonna say, hey.
Yeah. But so that's anyway. That was one more example of him inspiring people.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you wanted to know a little bit more about the human fly in real life, so let's go ahead and talk about that. As we've mentioned before, the human fly was a man named Rick Rojat. But I'm excited to talk about this issue, which is issue number 11, because even though every single one is emblazoned with because he's real across the top, this is the first issue that is actually based on a real event. The first issue is based very loosely on his DC-8 stunt. But this story is a mostly accurate portrayal, and I emphasize mostly, of the very real and spectacularly failed bus jump in Montreal in October 1977. That's when Rick Rojat and sausage scion Joe Ramacchieri decided to take the next step in taking the daredevil crown from Evel Knievel. Ramacchieri, you might remember, I've talked about him in the past. He was the brains and the money behind the human fly concept, and Rojat was the fly himself. It really seemed like Rojat had a real, probably one-sided beef with Knievel, who had set a record by jumping 13 buses at Wembley Stadium 2 years before. Rojat wanted to nearly triple that feat by jumping 36 buses. Kai Michelson, who was the stunt engineer that they approached to build the rocket cycle necessary for the jump, he told them they were nuts. That just was not going to happen. And he managed to talk the human fly down to 26 buses, which to my mind is still an outrageous number.
But absolutely.
Yeah, right? And it was still double Knievel's jump. In a September 2004 issue of Esquire, which is a great article if you can find it, the writer Michael O'Dell quotes Michelson as saying, "The math was crazy. The math was done by a lunatic." And, you know, it's not hard to imagine, especially if you've seen the video. And I sent you that video.
Yeah.
So just really quickly, what did you think of that?
Well, I was disappointed that the panel on the comic book page was not more like what I saw in the stands, saw on TV with, you know, what they were showing, you know, the view from the stands. And I was surprised that there was not a bigger crowd there. One of the things they pointed out was that he was in front of not very many people. And I saw that there was a platform over the buses, a kind of a runway, and that's what he fell into. That the fall looked different from the comic book. But I guess I was very concerned because in real life, he looked like he fell on his back.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So I'm concerned about what kind of injuries he had and whether or not he was able to recover. And I thought about, you know, it's a rocket cycle. I don't know much about rocketry, but I know one of the whole things of designing a rocket engine is trying to get the maximum power out of the chemical reaction that's happening with the rocket fuel.
Right.
And so I read a book called Rocket Girl about a female rocket scientist in the 60s, a true story. I recommend the book. But what they talked about was that if you do like the math, like you mentioned, there is a certain amount of energy that's supposed to come out of that chemical reaction, and you'll never get all of that energy because you can't have every molecule of one compound interacting with every molecule of its counterpart compound at the same time.
Sure.
And they design the engines to try and get as close to those ideal conditions as possible. And it's very clear watching that video that they did not get close enough.
Right. And the whole thing was kind of set up to be a disaster from the beginning. Kai Michelson is actually a very well-known and very accomplished engineer. He's designed rocket cars and rocket cycles, and he's set records, and he's done all sorts of things, right? So he is a very competent engineer. You mentioned that it was kind of an empty stadium. That was Gloria Gaynor was actually performing that night. It was a Gloria Gaynor concert, and the Human Fly was the opening act, because I guess that's what they used to do in those days. And this was at Montreal's Olympic Stadium. But by that time, disco was kind of on its way out.
Yeah.
Which is why the stadium was so empty. And also, the rocket cycle, against Michelson's advice, was untested. Apparently,
yeah, that's crazy.
Right? that makes no sense at all.
Out of all of these things, I think that's honestly the craziest thing. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, we all watched the right stuff, right? And we saw rocket tests. How many times did they test the thing and have it fail before you actually put even a monkey in it? They made sure they got it right before they put anybody in there. And so I'm just going to climb on a rocket cycle and try to go across 26 buses. That's, Kai Michelson was right. And they should have had Gloria Gaynor in the comics.
Oh man, how great would that have been? Yeah. So Michelson told them, look, this thing is untested, and the Ramachieri people, the Human Fly backers in real life, told him, give us the bike, we want the motorcycle now. And so that was that. The ramps were apparently also poorly constructed, and you can kind of see that in the video. Apparently there's struts sticking out near where the motorcycle is going to land, which is seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
So the last part of this puzzle was when the Human Fly took off from his end of the ramp. And by the way, the motorcycle was a Harley Davidson XL 1000 Sportster, for people who know their motorcycles. Cool. And he took off too fast and then hit the switch to trigger the double hydrogen peroxide boosters that were under the gas tank. So this motorcycle, which normally had a top speed of 130 miles per hour, was able to approach 300 miles per hour. So when you watch the video, you can kind of see that as soon as the fly leaves the ramp, he's going into a spin.
Yeah.
He is almost immediately flipping over.
That's why he landed on his back. Yeah.
And then he landed on his back. The motorcycle just noses up from the beginning.
Yeah.
And so instead of this graceful arc over these 26 buses, it is a brutal crash almost immediately into these school buses. And the Human Fly and the motorcycle just kind of skid all the way to the end into the other ramp.
Yeah.
It is hard to watch. Somehow, Roljat survived. There's in that video, there's also footage of him on a stretcher being carried out, and he manages to give a thumbs up.
Yep.
Which is pretty ballsy. Yeah. They carry him out, and that was the last time anyone saw the Human Fly. He was never seen or heard from again. And like you're saying, apparently he survived up to that point. I don't know what kind of injuries he had. I don't know how many of those were long lasting. And try as I might, I have not been able to find any information about Rick Roljat.
Yeah. And I tried to look him up when you first came out with this podcast, because I just got fascinated and apparently got bit by the bug. So
it's a rabbit hole, that's for sure.
Yeah. And, I think you've discussed it previously that was probably an alias. And because you would think that if this guy still existed, if he even had existed, that you could find something about him under that name, even if it was just, Rick Roljat living in Western Alberta, Right. So Yeah, you're right. The footage is hard to watch. He goes into that spin. There was no stability. I took an aerodynamics class once. I didn't get a good grade, but this is, but I do remember one or two things. And he did not have the lift, and that was something they actually mm-hmm. talked about in the comic book that did match up with real life. Is it he didn't have the lift that he needed to get higher, and he certainly didn't have at all the thrust to get across 26 buses. And maybe if he hadn't gone into the spin that you're talking about, he would have gone farther. But the still 300 miles an hour to go across, you know, to jump 26 buses. That's, I haven't done any math, but, you know, I've been passed on the expressway by people who were doing over 100 and 300 doesn't seem like enough to me.
Maybe not, you know, and I am not an engineer, as you mentioned. I'm a former journalist, so I don't know much. but I
really wasn't trying to say that.
Well, they say that journalists know a little bit about a lot of things, but not a lot about a lot of things. So, you know, as I said, I'm not an engineer, but to me the ramp also looks too, the angle seems too high. I don't know if that's true or not. But he seems to be going at a weird angle right almost from the beginning. And like you said, with that, the thrust that the motorcycle has and just everything else, it just right from the start, you can see it falling apart.
I mean, I guess one good thing is Kai Michelson probably had a list of things that he would never do again. Mm-hmm. And he probably had a list of things he would never allow himself to get bullied into again.
I can imagine. Yeah, I can imagine. It's, you know, and it was the heyday of stunts. You know, there was a big thing at the time. But yeah, I mean, obviously these were dangerous things being done by people who maybe all the time they didn't know quite what they were doing. You know, we don't know who Rick Rojat or the Human Fly really was. You know, there's rumors that he was just an employee of Ramacheri's sausage factory. Yeah,
it's not like there's a school for this.
Right. He could have very much just been some guy who was willing to put his life on the line, but without any real training. And that's the recipe for people to slam into a line full of buses.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're mentioning his sponsors, the meat packer backers, as I like to think of them. They were dismissive of whether or not this guy lived or died. When they were talking in the video that you sent me, or at least the one guy who was talking, and they even said that was part of the motivation for putting him in a mask, is if, you know, if something happened to him, they could replace him easily.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty cold. It's a pretty cold calculation that they were coming up with. It was more the Human Fly as IP than the Human Fly as a person.
Yeah. If they were like anybody in the comic book, I would say they were most like Mike the road manager.
Candy Mike. Yeah.
Candy Mike. That's it.
So let's get into that. Let's talk about issue 11 of The Human Fly. That was written by Bill Mantlo with pencils by Lee Elias. Mike Esposito was the inker. Irving Watanabe was the letterer. Colors were done by George Russo's. And Archie Goodwin was the editor. We also have a cover by Frank Robbins and Ernie Chan. Good stuff all around. This comic was on the stands April 4th, 1978, with a cover date of July of that year. Mike's Amazing World, What Would We Do Without You? Our story begins with a splash page of the Human Fly playing acoustic guitar. The Fly's PR man, Arnie Berman, enters the cabin asking if the Fly is okay. He says he is, but wants some time alone. Arnie goes to the front of the Fly's bus to tell pilot and driver Blaze Kendall and stunt engineer Ted Locke that the stuntman is still brooding. Blaze says he's been that way, quote, since Montreal. We then go into flashback and see the team's arrival in Montreal, a brief run-in with reporter Harmony White, who is now being forced to hound the Fly or risk losing her job, and a bit of foreshadowing about a tricky accelerator pump on the Fly's rocket cycle. And just like in real life, the comic book Fly ignores the pleas of his team and crashes just halfway over the line of buses. Back in the present, the stuntman has healed physically, but is struggling emotionally. Not only did the stunt fail, but more importantly, he feels he's failed in his mission to bring hope to others. Meanwhile, and let me warn people now, this is a very convoluted story. Meanwhile, Willie Silver, lead singer of Silver Charity, is pressured by his road manager, Candy Mike Flynn, to get ready to take the stage for their benefit show in St. Louis. In spite of a full house, thanks in part to the planned appearance of the human fly, Willie is terrified to go on. Every time he sings the band's hit, Death of a Superstar, something life-threatening happens. He's convinced that the song is cursed and wonders if tonight is the night he dies. The flying crew arrive in St. Louis, where ramps are being erected alongside the Gateway Arch. Tonight, the human fly will ride a motorcycle up the arch itself, but the crew is shocked when they hear the fly wants Death of a Superstar to be played during the stunt. Arnie thinks this is morbid, but the fly tells him he sees it as a song about hope and rebirth. After he walks away, Blaze tells the group, the fly feels as if he died in Montreal. He's trying to learn to live with himself again. Back at Silver Cherry's trailers, it turns out Willie Silver has reason to be worried. Candy Mike has been embezzling from the band, and the only thing left to do is collect the insurance money on the lead singer. Candy Mike doctors Willie's guitar to give him a lethal shock during the performance of the bankrupted band's hit song. In a brief aside, we see reporter Harmony White unexpectedly running into her boss, Mr. Braden. Braden is there to keep an eye on her, and Harmony takes the opportunity to tell him the human fly is not the fraud she thought he was. Braden doesn't care and tells her to get the story he wants or hit the bricks. Meanwhile, Silver Charity hits the stage to an enthusiastic crowd. After the first song, Willie introduces the human fly and the band launches into Death of a Superstar. The fly guns his motorcycle up the ramp, thinking this is it, a second chance, to make up for Montreal, and to renew my faith in myself. He zooms up the side of the arch while on the ground Harmony defies her boss Braden by quitting on the spot, and Candy Mike eagerly waits for his deadly trap to spring. Watching the human fly reach the top of the Gateway Arch, Willie Silver is suddenly inspired by the stuntman's courage and declares, I don't feel afraid anymore. Which is too bad, because that's when Candy Mike presses a button on a remote transmitter, electrocuting Willie, and suffering a shock himself from the feedback. The human fly, feeling renewed by his own triumph, sees that Willie is being killed and springs into action, rocketing down the other side of the arch to leap at the singer and breaking the connection. He immediately realizes the guitar has been sabotaged, while Harmony turns on Candy Mike, saying she saw a flash of light while the manager shouted in pain. Before Candy Mike can get out a retort, Harmony cracks him one on the chin, knocking the remote loose. Somehow, Willie is still alive, but barely. Badly burned, Willie knows he's dying, and asks the fly to make sure his music lives on. The human fly says he will, and picking up a guitar, walks to the microphone and announces to the crowd, Ladies and gentlemen, for Willie Silver, for all of us, I'd like to sing Birth of a Superstar. At the bottom of the page, we get a couple of blurbs. The first says the Montreal stunt took place as depicted, and the second says the human fly, stuntman extraordinaire, will soon become a recording artist as well. The end. Cap, what did you think?
I thought it was amazing. I genuinely thought it was inspirational. And I mean, it's a cheesy 1978 comic about a guy who is basically a living marketing gimmick, but that's how easy I am to influence.
I loved it. I love the story. I love how crazy it is, first of all. I mean, so much is happening in this comic. You don't see this anymore. You know, there's so decompression has been the rule for so long. This would be a 12-issue miniseries in itself. There is so much going on in this comic with so many people, so many characters, and so many moving parts. But it works really well. Yeah, and it is inspirational because not only does he help Willie get over his own fear, he gets over his own feelings. He has healed himself physically in the past. But this time we get to see him heal himself emotionally, which in a way I feel is even more powerful because those are things that we all go through. Those are feelings we all have of failing ourselves, of failing our loved ones, of not meeting our potential. Those are things that I think everyone can kind of identify with. And to see there's an image of the fly at the top of the arch when he gets there, and he just looks so relieved. It's a fantastic image.
Yeah, and then it's immediately followed by him not even stopping his bike at the end of the stunt, but riding up the steps to the music stage and mm-hmm. disconnecting Willie's guitar from the power, which is I thought that was impressive. That's he probably slowed down so he didn't kill Willie, but he never even stopped.
No, you know, and I don't know if, you know, I don't know what part of the country you're in or, you know, how many of our listeners have been to St. Louis, but that arch is big.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so just the idea of someone riding up it, not to mention writing down and saving a life by jumping from your still moving motorcycle to unplug a guitar is just an incredible idea.
Yeah, and I have no idea. I assume that would not be physically possible at any speed to ride a wheeled vehicle up over the arch and down. I don't know. Right. And I don't want to challenge anybody to do it, but it's funny because, I mean, this is a comic book page. It's not, you know, a movie screen, but like you say, that was still a really impressive stunt.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things I like, and I'll put them out there so I don't forget as I'm talking about them. I like the art. And I like the fact that the crew got a little more, quote unquote, camera time in this issue. We've seen the crew here and there, mostly in the background. But here they're a little more active. They're a little more involved in what's going on. And I love these characters. I especially love Blaze. I would love to see Blaze Kendall somehow come back into Marvel Comics, of course, with the Human Fly. But she's just such a great character. And it's great to see them interacting not only with the Fly, but with each other.
Yep.
Because you really get this sense of them being a team.
Yeah, you also get a sense of some real personality, too, mm-hmm. which is interesting because they are supporting characters. And you're right, they haven't gotten a lot of, not screen time, I guess, panel time prior to this. You really see, especially Arnie and Ted, you know, Ted is probably a lot like Kai Michelson, frustrated and trying to make things right so that things will be safe. Right. You know, Arnie's the guy who's trying to market the Human Fly, who it seems to be someone who is naturally humble, and mm-hmm. yet he has a message he wants to tell the whole world, and he's going to do it through his own celebrity. And that seems very contradictory, although I can imagine somebody being exactly like that. And I would think that being his manager would be a chore. you know, you see Harmony interacting with her boss, who is, right. You know, her boss is probably the most two-dimensional character in the whole run. He's a flaming jerk the whole time. Mm-hmm. But she's really conflicted, and then she has that inspirational moment, or I guess not so much inspirational as inspired. She's inspired to quit her job and tell her boss to stuff it.
Right, and she has the most interesting arc in this run because she does have an arc. You know, it starts from the beginning and it goes all the way to the end. And you see this transformation in Harmony. And again, that's because of the Fly's influence. It's really interesting because it's kind of Harmony is kind of standing in for us, you know, for the cynical reader. And once she lets a little trust in and once she allows herself to see that the Human Fly does not have ulterior motives, that he is just trying to help people. That does inspire her to not only see things from a different perspective, but to kind of be a better person herself.
Yeah, absolutely. So this brings to mind a question I want to ask you, Max, as a former journalist, mm-hmm. does any of this ring true? Have you ever had a boss who wanted you to compromise your ethics? Have you ever had to take a stand on a story? Does any of this parallel or is it completely unrealistic?
Luckily, no. During my time, and for one thing, I started out as a reporter, primarily as a, now that you mention it, yes. It was nowhere near anything like this, but at one point I was doing restaurant reviews. And I went to a place and the chips, the tostadas, it was a Mexican restaurant, had greasy chips. And I wrote that in my review and that was published. And the restaurant owners were not happy about that. And they let my editor know. And then the editor let me know and had me go out and review the place a second time, hoping that my opinion would be different this time. The chips were still greasy, and I said so, and I was told that my services would no longer be needed for that particular column. So, anything like that,
wow.
I have not personally seen. That's very much a holdover from the idea of yellow journalism and newspapers with an agenda. And which, of course, we still see today. with some publications, but for the most part, most newspapers are just trying to be as objective as they can, and trying to do the best job that they can with the tools that they have. Yeah, I'm sure that there are examples of this out there, but I would say that those are the outliers and not necessarily the industry as a whole.
Max, I noticed you keep mentioning publications, and you're not bringing up cable news as a possible example.
Well, I think that is probably obvious enough that people will know which outlets have which agendas. Cable news is a whole different thing.
Yeah,
that's a whole other thing. So, could I see this happening? I mean, because you know, Harmony is a TV reporter.
Yeah,
you know, she's not a print reporter. She is a TV reporter. She always has a cameraman in tow, who we never get to know. We never know his name. We never know anything about him. But yeah, I could see if this were to be updated, I could pretty readily guess what cable news channel Harmony would be working for.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of appreciation for cable news in general. And I always feel like if they're not, and I'll soapbox a little here, you can edit it out later, but I always feel like if they're not pushing one agenda, they're pushing the other agenda, and they're not terribly well informed, and they're trying to take a little bit of cheaply acquired story and stretch it out for as much time as possible.
Which is exactly what's happening with Harmony White and the Human Fly, actually. You know, because this should be like a one-time thing. Oh, he came through here and, you know, this is, you know, we think he's a fraud there. But Harmony is actually assigned to follow the fly around the country and to expose him as a fraud, as they think he is. And eventually, like in this issue, it's mentioned that they don't even care that whether he's a fraud or not. They just want to sell this somehow. You know, they want to sell the controversy. So yeah, so that's definitely some real world parallels there too.
Yeah, and I have to wonder. I mean, this guy Carl Braden, like, he's trying to milk this into a big expose. Like, is there not another lead or another avenue he could go down? It seems like it would be easier and cheaper and faster to find a real story than it would be to try and make one up.
Right. And, you know, and Harmony basically has the Human Fly beat. As far as I know, that's all she does, which does not usually happen. Yeah, it's very interesting because at the time that this was published, obviously there was not cable news. It was all the big three broadcasting channels, I guess. And
yeah,
but this kind of anticipated a style of TV journalism that wouldn't show up for another 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I agree. Did you notice on the page where Harmony quit that she was still holding her microphone to her face? I was hoping we would find out that she had been recording the whole time that her editor said he didn't care whether or not the Human Fly was a fraud.
You know, I did not notice that. That's very interesting because she actually quits a couple of times.
Yeah.
She quits once and then he basically starts barking at her and she tells him, hey, if you don't remember, I quit.
Yeah. Well, the first time she quits is as the fly is going up the arch. And I mean, and honestly, I would have stopped conversation and just stared for a second.
Right.
But she has a microphone right there. And I mean, it obviously turned into nothing. And I was seeing foreshadowing where there was none, but I thought it was funny.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's true. She is still holding her. And I assume that they are recording all this because the cameraman is right there. And yeah,
well,
she's speaking into the microphone.
Yeah. And he's going up the arch. So, you know, they're recording. Mm-hmm. So that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, and the second time she quits, she, in a very 70s way, tells him to stuff it.
Yes.
Which, you know, Harmony just keeps endearing herself to me more and more.
Yeah, I'm hoping we continue to get to see her and that we get to see what happens in the next 8 issues.
Yes, we do.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. No, Harmony is too good a character to waste. So what did you think of that cover by Frank Robbins?
Oh, I thought it was great. And I'm, you know, not to sound like I'm down on artists all the time, I'm not really a Frank Robbins fan. I've read his Captain America issues, and great story. His anatomy to me is wonky. And it's just, and it's not so much that it's off. I mean, the anatomy matches his style, I guess. Mm-hmm. But his style just isn't pleasant to look at. At least it wasn't in those. Now, Julius Swartz famously loved him because of the energy. And I think I started to see that in the Frank Robbins. I don't remember how many of the issues he did here in the Human Fly, but looking at the stuff in the gallery pages, I started to see why there was appeal there. Mm-hmm. And I can certainly see it in this cover, because partly one thing I like about it is that the Human Fly looks like he's wearing real clothes.
Right.
And, you know, they always talk about that over on Kevin Maguire made everybody look like they were wearing clothes in the early issues of JLI. Shout out to Shag. So I appreciated that. There's tremendous detail on those buses. Even like the names on the front of the buses is matching what we see later in the comic. You can pick out Ted and Blaze, and you know they're very distinctive. And you know, and obviously it doesn't match up exactly what happened in the comic as far as how the crash happened, but it's clear he's going to crash.
Right.
And you know, and it's a very exciting shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, just to describe it a little more, that's we're obviously looking at it from ground level in the stadium.
Yep.
We have Ted and Blaze in the foreground. They're looking up at the fly, and there's a trail of smoke coming from behind the motorcycle. He's starting to like flip off of it. He's not sitting in the motorcycle. He's basically just kind of holding on. And from the smoke, you can see that this is not a straight line that he's going into. And yeah, it's obvious that he's about to crash. And, you know, and like you said, I really like the perspective that Robbins uses here, because it's kind of up and at an angle. So when you can see the stadium seats on the left hand of this image, and it's kind of at a tilt. So it kind of gives an even better sense of things being off balance. And it just really works. My only complaint is that you can kind of see the fly's face underneath the helmet, which looks sort of like a football helmet for some reason.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see an expression on his face, which you don't normally see any kind of expression because of the way the mask works. And that threw me off a little bit, but I do love that it has his signature rocket on the top.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a cool helmet. So,
and he's wearing his cape.
Yeah. And the cape looked even cooler in the comic with the, it looked like somebody had taken a Japanese rising sun flag and like added stars and, you know, and more pizzazz to it. Yeah. So I keyed in on the helmet when I saw the cover and I flipped forward, because you don't normally see him wear a helmet, and he didn't even wear a helmet, and he should have, when he was in St. Louis going up the arch. So I flipped to the page of the crash in Montreal, and I thought about what you were talking about, it like how the helmet seems to have a cage, and I think that's just an illusion of the kind of white cross on his mask.
Oh, you might be helmet. Right. Yeah.
And I don't know how, having zero artistic ability myself, I don't know how he could have drawn that so that you could see that the white on his mask was slightly deeper than mm-hmm. the exterior of the helmet. Anyway, that's my theory.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Yeah, that could be. It didn't even occur to me. But yeah, that's because that's what his mask looked like, is that white cross, you know, across the median going both ways.
Yep.
So yeah. So what did you think of Elias's artwork on the interior?
I thought it was great. He's a little cartoony in places. Mm-hmm. But not in a negative way. Actually, I'm flipping through the scans as we're talking, and yeah, it's much clearer in the comic where they do a much closer shot. It's much clearer that the mask and the helmet, the whites, the white of the mask and the white of the helmet are separate.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that everybody, first splash page, actually.
Yeah. That, oh, yeah. And with the guitar in the bus. Yeah.
You know, because everything has a texture to it. There's posters from past shows on the wall. And the body language for the fly, he looks exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, he's playing this guitar and his fingers work here because he actually looks like he's fingering a chord. And it's not something you would normally think would work as a splash page, but for me, it really does.
Yeah, I agree. When you first talked about the splash page a few minutes ago, I thought about how this is, you know, a guy sitting on a bus playing guitar is not what you think of when you think about a comic book superhero splash page.
Right.
But he's got so much emotion as he's doing this. The Lee Elias, I thought he really brought it as far as, like you said, the body language of telling you that this guy's going through something. You have to read it to find out what that is, but yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I really appreciate about Elias is the way he draws faces.
Yep.
On page 3, there's basically a group shot of the crew and the fly and Harmony and our unnamed cameraman. You can just see kind of the disdain on the faces of the crew and the frustration on the flies from the fly's eyes behind the mask.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Harmony is there, but she doesn't look angry or even like she's just trying to get the story. Her face is softer and there's a sense of vulnerability there, which really goes with the idea that she is doing something she doesn't want to be doing.
Right. She looks tentative, like she wants to get the story and be apologetic at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the dialogue matches that, where it's got her stuttering over words a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. So although I have to say, and they are all kind of looking at us, the crew is all looking askance at Harmony. But in my head, Ted is just mad that he's not already working on the motorcycle.
It could be that fits with Ted's character so far.
And that's
mirrored again a few pages later when they see that the fly is going to crash, but this time everyone has a look of horror on the face. And you know, again, just Elias does such a good job saying so much with the way he draws faces. It's really well done.
Absolutely. So on that same page where they're all looking horrified at the crash, you see, and I don't know why I'm so fascinated by this, but so the fly's back wheel hits one of the buses, which is different from what we saw where he starts to spin and what we saw in the video where he started to spin and he really like came down on his back.
Yeah.
And you see that he's hitting the buses. He's not hitting a platform on top of the buses. And he actually like crashes through the bus into it.
Yeah.
And if anything, this crash looks even worse than the real crash.
It really does. It really does. Because he goes right through the roof of that bus into the bus itself.
Yeah.
And they kind of just like have to pull him out of the hole that he, I don't know why they didn't just go through the doors. I guess they're put in there pretty tight, but
yeah,
they have to pull him out in the hole that he just created.
Yeah, I would be terrified to do. Like, you know, if he didn't have a broken back before, he will now.
right, because they kind of have to fold him to get out of there. Yeah, it does. It does not look like he's getting the best medical care there. It's a pretty well drawn, because you feel it. I mean, you look at that image and you're going, oh man, that looks bad. that looks really bad.
Yeah.
So. Who do you think Willie Silver is based on? I keep getting Donny Osmond vibes, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. There were so many, you know, skinny, long-haired,
Hill
singers of that era. He kind of reminds me of a darker-haired Gibb brother. Like, he could be Andy Gibb.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I don't know. And the song, the Death of a Superstar song, immediately made me think of Shooting Star by Bad Company.
Oh, yeah.
But I think this might actually predate that song.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I would have to look that up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, because he's dressed very kind of like in a T-Rex, kind of not T-Rex, the dinosaur, T-Rex, T-Rex, the singer, in kind of way where he's wearing a jacket that's open to his bare chest.
Yeah.
Actually, the entire band is dressed like that, with big silver belts with an S on it. He's wearing a long yellow scarf. Pretty sure they're all wearing heels or platform shoes from the look of it. Yeah, it's that kind of glam rock feel to it to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm curious. I'd like to know what other people, who they think that he might be based on, or who, you know, he's probably based on a few people. But yeah, poor Willie. He does not get the best end of this.
Yeah, so there are a few more emotional moments to talk about in here. Mm-hmm. One of them is that, you know, Willie dies. I mean, the only thing the human fly accomplishes in this, besides inspiring people, is the stunt on the Gateway Arch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he doesn't even stop the bad guy. Harmony stops the bad guy.
Yeah.
And breaks her microphone in the process. But,
a little symbolism there.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. That's a really good metaphor. But I already said the human fly impressed me greatly with his attempt to save Willie. But this is another failure for him to deal with in mm-hmm. that it didn't work. And I think maybe this is Mantlo's genius and why we can get so caught up in this melodrama, because most of the time in the superhero comics, they save everybody. If Spider-Man is challenged to save MJ or the school children, he figures out a way to save both. And sometimes the human fly just fails.
Yes, he is the fly, but he is also the human fly.
He
is only human. You know,
his weakness is right there in the name.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And but again, that's kind of what I appreciate about it, is that he keeps going. He tries. Okay.
Yeah, so he kept – this was the other emotional thing I wanted to talk about. So the whole backstory is that he had this serious car crash, right? Mm-hmm. And on the splash page, in the little opening blurb that tells you the origin that all Marvel Comics used to have, it says specifically it was a crash in 1971 in North Carolina, which is so specific, it makes me think, you know, that must be corrected to Rick Rojack in real life, you know? So he has this, and, you know, a significant portion of his skeleton is replaced or reinforced. He comes back from that physical therapy, working out, develops the courage to do these insane stunts.
Right.
And I don't know how much of this story in real life is true, but at least that's the story we're working with inside the comic. And then has another accident that is almost as bad as the first one.
Yeah.
And then comes back from that and then decides to do it again. And I thought about what he's thinking about as he's playing guitar on the bus and he's trying to get his belief in himself back. He explicitly says later in the comic. And I was just thinking, if you're doing these kinds of dangerous things, I think there are only two attitudes you can have, at least from the people I've seen. And one is that you have to think nothing can happen to you. Either you're that good or you are that blessed and charmed that you're going to be fine no matter what. Pretty much how we all feel when we're 16 years old, right?
Right.
The other thing is just being okay with whatever happens. And I think the fly is an example of somebody who he already knows this can happen to him because of what happened in the car crash. And then he has it reinforced in this story. He has it reinforced in Montreal and he feels like he's already died and he's living in his next life or his second life or however they say it. He's born again. I don't know. That resonated with me as a real human reaction that somebody might have. Does that make sense to you?
It does, because you know what you're and to go with what you're saying, people do go through a lot of things in their lives, and some people find it within themselves to somehow get past those things or to somehow learn to live with them. And you know, and some people don't, and they'll have problems with that later on in their lives. But the people who somehow manage to get something positive out of extremely difficult situations, I think that it's the complete opposite of nihilism, because it's not a death wish and it's not this idea of like, oh, nothing matters because we're all going to die. And with the fly, I think what he's exemplifying is that right now we're all alive and we need to make the most of that that we can. That is something that is a very difficult concept to kind of get across, especially in what on its face is a pretty overboard comic book. But I think that Mantlo is pretty dedicated to getting this idea across in a lot of different ways. And, you know, on page 21, where the human fly is driving his motorcycle up what looks almost like a completely vertical grade on the arch, the image itself is, you know, you can see the people small on the ground. You can see his shadow on the arch itself, and he's driving up. But Mantlo writes this really nice kind of, not a soliloquy, but he does a nice job of writing what the fly is thinking and feeling. And he talks about how he lifted himself up to prove that, prove to the world that hope is the purest of beliefs. Hope in man's ability to triumph over despair. Witness a man who loves living that belief, knowing that others will profit from his example. Witness a man who will never fear failure again. And that doesn't mean that he is never going to fail or that he doesn't think he's going to fail, but he's not afraid of failing. That is a powerful message.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Okay, we're definitely seeing the same thing out of this. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the moments of my life when I've had that kind of resolve that that the human fly, not that I would ever go up the Gateway Arch, but the, you know, anything close to the kind of resolve that the human fly is demonstrating here. And what I really mean is just the being okay with whatever happens, right? So mm-hmm. the equanimity, maybe the, it, for me, it's wrapped up in my faith and my trust in a God that has everything under control, whether I like the decisions he makes or not, but sure. and his plan is better than mine, but that's me. But there are lots of people who come to that place of accepting the fact that bad things can happen or things that seem bad to us from our perspective, and that's okay. And we're not going to let it stop us or rule us. And regardless of how you get there, I respect the position, I guess.
Yeah, no, and that's pretty much what the human fly talks about is he's coming back down. He says, I did it. Do you hear me, world? I live again. I've proven my message is real. Because he is, like, again, you know, his message is not just a message. It's his mission.
Yeah.
And he says, your faith in me has healed me.
Yeah.
I believe in myself once more. And he says, thank you. And it says in the caption, there are tears beneath the crimson mask, tears of joy. And, you know, all of those things are things that you would not normally see in a comic, and especially not in a late 70s superhero comic of someone talking about faith and faith in themselves, faith in their message, and crying from the joy of rediscovering that. You know, I always try to say that I try not to take these. I try not to find more in these comics than is actually there. But there is a lot there. It surprises me every time.
Yeah, I don't, you know, Mechanical Birds and Blue Grizzly Bears aside from previous issues, I don't think anybody can accuse you of finding something that isn't there in this comic because, I mean, Mantlo explicitly put it on the page.
Yeah, it's there. It's all right there. Again, it's a great story. I love the way it wraps up. It ties a lot of things up that have been kind of dangling for a while and creates new things, again, with Harmony. You kind of see her take a turn in the way she is seeing the fly and how she's going to react with him. But now you also see that she is, you know, you're left with the question of, like, now what does she do? Because she just quit her job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And did it in a pretty final way. You know, no, she's not going to be going back to that job.
Nor would she want to. I mean, you know.
Right. She's not the same person she was.
Yeah. And she made a decision that she probably wishes she'd made 6 issues ago. But I don't mean to imply any judgment with that because it's a very hard decision to make. But yeah, I do. You've read ahead. I do wonder what's going to happen to her because I don't know if Arnie needs any help on the human fly publicity machine. But except now that human fly is apparently going to be a recording artist.
Right. And that is another amazing panel. You know, after we see, this is the final panel of the issue, and after the Fly has promised Willie Silver that he's going to carry on with his music, and, you know, again, it's worth saying, Willie Silver's dying.
Yeah.
I doubt that he has survived this issue, but you do see him at the bottom being held by held up by Ted and Blaze and Arnie. But the Fly is walking up to the microphone with that with Willie's acoustic guitar, which I'm surprised is not fried. And behind him is a huge banner that says the Human Fly and Silver Charity Benefit Performance, which kind of is hinting like it's going to become the Human Fly and Silver Charity.
Yeah.
And that is a turn when I first read this issue. I could not believe it was so out of nowhere that I could not wrap my mind around it.
So now that makes me wonder, did the accident in Montreal and the subsequent disappearance of the Human Fly, did that basically take the chains off Bill Mantlo and say, dude, you can write whatever you want? And
maybe.
And so, yeah. And also, was there a delay in publication? I should have looked this up, but I didn't. Like, did the Human Fly come out? You know, I guess it was probably a bi-monthly comic, but it, did it come out on schedule without missing a beat after this accident?
As far as I know, it came out on schedule and it was monthly.
It was a monthly comic.
Mm-hmm. But the comics were coming out slower than the Human Fly's appearances. So when this came out, not when this came out, when the Human Fly did his bus jump, the Human Fly number 2 had just come out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the comics essentially were kind of playing catch up with what was happening in real life. So, and I don't know how far in advance Mantlo worked, but yeah. So it took a while for them to get to an incident that basically took the Human Fly out of the public eye. So that's a really interesting aspect to this, that when this came out, the Fly had already been essentially gone for a few months.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I don't know either. I've never been involved in comic book publication, and they told me not to hang around the building anymore. But so let's say it's 6 months gap, right, between however far Mantlo is working ahead and then the time is required for printing and distribution. That still meant he had several months, a few months, to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he decided, like, okay, here's the point in the arc where I'm going to insert the Montreal accident, and I'm gonna use it. Some writers nowadays, with the crossover events, they find out that, you know, you're writing Moon Knight or whatever, and something has to happen to Moon Knight because it's critical to the crossover story. And they decide, okay, well, if that's going to happen, then I can use it to tell the story. I'll exploit the event, right? I'll use it to tell the story I want to tell. And I wonder if that's what Mantlo was doing.
I think there was some of that was definitely happening with Mantlo, because that seems to be what Mantlo did in terms of his work. I think there was also influence from the Ramacheri family, or, you know, the Ramacheri, Joe Ramacheri, and I believe his brother. You know, they were licensing it to Marvel. And I don't know how much influence they might have had. But again, so by this point, when this comic came out, the Fly was already, let's say, retired.
Yeah.
Right. But here's an interesting little fact, which kind of puts my mind in a twist every time I think about it. So Joe Ramacheri, also, he had dreams of being a musician himself. Right.
Really?
That was something that he was, you know, open about. That was something he wanted to do. So here's the story. Before she was famous, Cyndi Lauper used to have a job running checks back and forth between Joe Ramacheri and the Marvel offices.
Really?
This is Cyndi Lauper.
Okay.
And then later, in the early 80s, Ramacheri backed a band called The Human Fly and Red Rider. That band was fronted by Cyndi Lauper's then-boyfriend, David Wolfe, and the band would perform a New Jersey concert in an attempt to reposition the Human Fly as a pop star.
Really?
It obviously never went anywhere, but there was an attempt to turn the Human Fly into a musical act.
Okay, but that's after this comic book, right?
Yes.
Okay, so for all we know, Bill Mantlo inspired the Ramacheri to do this.
That is also possible, yeah.
Wow, okay. this story has... I mean, the story has, the real story has more twists and turns than would be plausible in a comic.
the real life story is so fascinating to me. And unfortunately, a lot of the people involved are either no longer with us or can't be found.
Yeah.
And the only person I know of for sure who's still around is Kai Michelson.
Well, and Cyndi Lauper.
And Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah. Who needs to be interviewed on camera.
I'm trying to get Kai Michelson.
Okay, cool.
But Cyndi Lauper is not returning my emails.
All right.
It is a crazy, crazy story. You know, we mentioned rabbit holes, and this is definitely something that you can fall into very easily.
Yeah.
So it's great. It truly is almost like comics come to life.
Yeah. The interaction is very strange. The thing that popped to mind was G.I. Joe. You know, they'd come out with the Sergeant Slaughter G.I. Joe figure. Right. And he would show up in the cartoon and then maybe in the comic book. I don't remember if he ever did or not. But you know, they'd come out with a new action figure and then you'd have to feature that in the comic book. And that was the interaction with real life. That was nothing compared to this. So it must have been. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, they kept more of a line there. But this is just all over the place.
I would have loved to have been in those conversations in the Marvel offices. What are we going to do with this?
You know, now that I think about it, there should be people in the Marvel offices who maybe have some memories of this. Maybe, you know, they did a lot of work, so they might not remember this too much. But yeah, it's definitely something I would like to know.
Yeah.
You know, because the human fly, and this comes up in a later issue. The human fly, he does visit the Marvel offices.
Yeah, so I've seen those pictures, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's enough here that you could make a good documentary out of this, Max.
Yeah. Well, someone is trying to do that. Someone is supposedly working on a movie, but every time it's brought up, it disappears again. Not unlike Rick Rojat. It's for some reason this just has not popped up. So
maybe somebody's trying to keep the story off the air.
Well, see, that's how rumors start.
Well, if not to wish any trouble on you, but if you decide to take up the mantle and try to find out the real truth about the human fly, I will contribute to your Kickstarter.
Well, we'll see, because this is going to it's in there. It's in my head now. Well, you know, Cap, is there anything else that you would like to say about this issue?
No, I'm spent. Clearly I had a lot to say, but I think I'm done now. Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, no, thank you. And so why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Well, the joke line that I always use is that Captain Entropy is wherever discord and chaos and decay are needed on the internet, and there's plenty already, so I am very difficult to find, but... So I'm not on social media and Alias. Most of the time, you can find me commenting on Fire and Water podcast websites. You can occasionally hear me or comments I have made on the Long Box Crusade. And who knows, maybe I'll expand my presence. But right now, that's where I am.
Thank you for being on the show. I truly appreciate it. Anytime you want to come on any of my shows, please just let me know, because this has been a lot of fun.
Well, I appreciate it, and it's been a lot of fun for me, too. You know, this is like the sixth time I've been on a podcast. They've all been a blast, and you're great to work with, and I would be happy to appear on any show you've got.
Oh, well, thank you so much. The Death Defying Human Flycast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. If you'd like to subscribe or leave a comment for the Human Flycast, you can do that on our website at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter at twitter.com/FW Podcast, and be sure to tag the network with #FW Podcasts. The Death Defying Human Fly List, a playlist including all the music featured in each episode so far, can be found on Spotify, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes. If you'd like to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network even more, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcasts, where you can make a one-time or monthly contribution and unlock various rewards, including getting name-checked on this or any network show of your choice. Just like Gord Tolton and my primo from the hood, David Ace Gutierrez. Support the network, reap the rewards. Thanks again, High Flyers, and remember, the wildest superheroes are real.